So the question of what distinguishes science from pseudoscience, of course, is one of the central questions of the philosophy of science, and nobody has come up with a good answer.
Greetings, dear listeners. I'm your host, Max Marty.
And I'm your host, Daniel Walters.
And you're listening to the one and only Cryonics Underground podcast. Today's guest is philosopher, author, and professor extraordinaire, Dr. Theodore Schick Jr. of Muhlenberg College. Schick is the author of How to Think About Weird Things and Doing Philosophy, and if you're curious about his sci-fi bona fides, his work has been featured in numerous books, including The Philosophy of the Matrix, Star Trek and Philosophy, and several others. And I can confidently say that I wouldn't be here doing what I'm doing today if it wasn't for Schick's influence on how I think about the world and things like cryonics. So it is with a great honor that today we bring you Ted Schick. Theodore Schick, welcome to Cryonics Underground.
Good to be here. Good to see you guys.
We're very lucky to have you today. This is an interview that I've personally been looking forward to since, full disclosure, you know, I was in your classroom 15 years ago, and you were a big part of why I personally became interested in subjects such as the philosophy of science, of course, but also futurism and transhumanism. And ultimately, I would say, if it hadn't been for you, I wouldn't likely be a cryonicist today. I'm very excited to have a chance to get to talk to you about this, and Daniel is, getting a chance to meet you for the first time and deal with some of these philosophical issues when it comes to these topics. But I would like to jump in here and basically start with trying to understand how one should categorize and frame subjects like cryonics and related transhumanist subjects. A lot of people would frame these subjects within the banner of pseudoscience. That is to say, somehow it's almost a science or it's almost scientific thinking, but really it's more quackery. You know, it's somehow deceptive. It's a fraudulent way to think about it. There's something fishy is going on in trying to discuss this subject. And this is one of the primary wheelhouses that you're involved in, is trying to understand how one thinks about scientific questions, how one thinks about philosophical questions, and indeed how one thinks about the intersection of those two, or things that shouldn't be in those categories at all. So I'd like to kick us off with, what is pseudoscience, and would cryonics fit in that category? And if not, why not?
Well, actually, I don't think that cryonics should be considered to be any kind of science, regular science or pseudoscience, because it really doesn't offer explanations. So I think that something to be called a science has to be trying to explain some part of the physical world and so forth. And cryonics is not in the business of making explanations. It's a technology. It's an attempt to apply some of the results that are found in some of the other sciences, you know, like physics and chemistry and neurology and all that sort of stuff. But no, it's just a technology. So I don't think it should be considered a pseudoscience. So the question of what distinguishes science from pseudoscience, of course, is one of the central questions of the philosophy of science. And nobody has come up with a good answer, because whenever anybody has proposed what's called a demarcation criterion, and so this is a criterion that's used to demarcate science from non-science or science from pseudoscience, there's always counterexamples. So the most famous demarcation criterion was one that was invented by Karl Popper. He used the falsifiability criterion. He said that something is not a science if it can't be falsified. And there's something to that. What he means to say is that if there's no empirical data that would be inconsistent with the hypothesis, then it really doesn't tell us anything about the world. So, for example, consider the statement, either it's raining or it's not raining, right? So if somebody tells you either it's raining or it's not raining, do you learn anything about the weather? No. And the reason is, it's not falsifiable. There's no possible data that would count against it. It's consistent with all possible data. Now, the things that Popper wanted to leave out of account, unfortunately, like astrology, for example, is falsifiable because it does make predictions like people born under the same sign should have same personality characteristics or something like that. And that's been tested and has been false. So it's may well be a necessary condition for something to be a pseudoscience, but it's not a sufficient condition. And so I think that the real question in the, this is a little bit off topic, but I think the real question with regard to science versus pseudoscience is not what makes something a real science as opposed to a pseudoscience, but when does something offer a real explanation as opposed to a fake explanation? So I think that the things that we consider pseudosciences are really pseudosciences because they offer pseudo explanations. So take creationism, for example. I mean, so creationism is a classic example of pseudoscience, or intelligent design would be a classic example of pseudoscience. But of course, those things are falsifiable. And if you're a young Earth creationist and you say, well, gee, the Earth is 6,000 to 10,000 years old and all the geological features on the Earth were caused by this flood. And all that stuff is testable. And of course, it's been tested and it's been found to be false. But I think what makes creationism, for example, a pseudoscience is that the explanation that it offers doesn't improve our understanding of anything. So to say God did it is not to leave us in a better position than we were before. So the example that I like to use is, suppose that you're an engineer and you're charged with trying to figure out why this bridge collapsed. Okay, and so you want to look at all the various different hypotheses. And suppose that somebody comes up to you and says, oh, I know why the bridge collapsed. And so you ask him to step into your office. And he says, yeah, can you tell me why? And he says, well, an alien zapped it with a ray gun. Okay. And you say, well, gee, can you tell me a little bit about this alien? What sort of qualities does he have? He says, well, the alien is totally incomprehensible. We have no idea what qualities he has. No one knows anything about his true nature. He says, well, can you tell me anything about the ray gun? So what kind of energy do you use to bring down the bridge? He says, the energy is totally unlike any other energy that's ever been seen in this universe. And he says, well, can you tell me a little bit about his motivation? You know, why did he want to shoot down the bridge? He says, no, his motives are totally unfathomable. Nobody understands why he does it, right? And so, I mean, at that point, I don't think you want to include the alien explanation in the possible hypothesis of why this bridge went down, right? So any explanation that tries to account for an event as the result of the actions of some agent, right, needs to tell us who the agent is, how the agent did it, and what the motives were behind it, right? And the creationists never do that, right? I mean, I guess they never played Clue. I don't know what the problem is. But yeah, I mean, to say God did it is no better than saying the alien did it. Creationism is a pseudoscience because it's a pseudo-explanation. It doesn't tell us anything.
Let me ask you, Ted, a bit of a clarifying question. So you said that if I make the statement that it either is raining or it is not raining, that's not an explanation of anything, but since it doesn't give us any more information about the world.
Right.
If I make the statement that it is, in fact, raining right now here, that does presume some new information about the world. And so that could be true or it could be false.
Right.
But if I make the statement, it will be raining next week on Tuesday. And then you can, what category does that fall into? Because of course you could then say to me, well, that's not an explanation because it is completely not falsifiable today, right now. It can't be falsified. And then somebody said, well,
right, but falsifiable, at least as Popper used it, is falsifiable in principle at some time, right? So it's not like falsifiable right now. There has to be some possible data that could be gathered at some possible time in order for it to be falsifiable. So that would certainly count as a perfectly legitimate empirical statement. Even though we can't test it right now, it's a legitimate thing.
So then in that case, would cryonics fall into the category of a perfectly legitimate a falsifiable statement if I said, I predict that in, between 300 years and 700 years from now, we will have the technology to bring people out of cryonic suspension, bring people who were put into cryonic suspension today out of it within 300 to 700 years? Or does that start to fall into some kind of you know, I'm playing fast and loose with this because I'm giving such long time horizons that it might as well be unfalsifiable.
No. So as long as it's in principle possible to find some empirical data that can confirm it or refute it, then it's a perfectly legitimate empirical statement. So yeah, and on those grounds, Chronics is not saying anything that's nonsensical. In that sense, it's not science and so forth. I think that, you know, one of the things about Chronics is people consider it to be weird. So I've written this textbook called How to Think About Weird Things.
Which I, you know, our audience can't see, but I'm holding it up in front of the camera here.
So what edition is that?
This is the fourth edition.
Oh, so it's actually in the eighth edition now.
I'm a little bit behind the times.
but I think it's important to understand that there's different levels of weirdness, and it's important to understand what makes something weird. And actually, I think cryonics, according to some people, falls under each of these levels of weirdness. So maybe it's worthwhile taking a look at them. So what makes something seem weird is that it seems impossible. And the interesting thing is that there's different types of possibility. So there's, for example, a logical possibility and physical possibility and technological possibility. So something is logically impossible if it violates a law of logic. And of course, the fundamental principle of logic is the law of non-contradiction. So for example, a married bachelor is logically impossible. There cannot be a married bachelor because nothing can be both married and unmarried at the same time. And not even God can make a married bachelor. I mean, God can't do the logically impossible. And every theologian would agree with that. God can't make the number three an even number. Try as he might, he can't do that, right? He can't make round squares. He can't make four-sided triangles. So if something is logically impossible, then of course it can't exist. And I think that some people object to cryonics because they think it's logically impossible. And the reason that they would think it's logically impossible is they would say, well, if you're dead, then it's impossible for you to be revived. So to be dead and then brought back to life again is a contradiction in terms, right? So that would be one sort of notion with regard to that sort of stuff. But again, the problem is that we found that things can be dead according to our definition of death and yet can be brought back to life. So when you say that something is dead and can't be brought back to life, I think you have to be careful about what you mean by dead. I mean, so if dead by definition means can't be brought back to life, then indeed chronics would be logically impossible. But if death just means, say, you've clinically died, your heart has stopped beating and your lungs have stopped breathing, or even that your brain has ceased to function, that doesn't mean that you can't be brought back to life. And we have all sorts of examples of course, clinically dead people have been brought back to life, but people whose brain has ceased to function who have been brought back to life. So actually, I think that the record in terms of somebody who's fallen into really cold water is 66 minutes. So people have been underwater for 66 minutes and then, you know, been warmed up and thawed out and been brought back to life. So, you know, that stuff happens all the time. There's also this procedure, it's called deep hypothermic cardiac arrest, that they often use on people if they want to operate on the brain, for example, and remove a blood clot that threatens to cause an aneurysm or something. And what they'll do is they'll cool the body down and then they'll drain all the blood out of your head. And then they'll operate on the brain and the neurons won't be firing. There'll be no detectable activity going on in the brain there. They'll remove the blood clot. They'll put the blood back in and you're good to go. And this has been done hundreds of times. This is not, sort of a rare thing. And one of the most remarkable things, this is in the April 18th, 2019 issue of Nature, the great science journal. They've taken a pig's brain out of a pig's body for 4 hours and brought it back to life, without putting in any cryopreservation or anything like that. They just let it sit at room temperature for 4 hours, and they were able to perfuse it with a substance. They just call it Brain X. I don't know what's in this substance. But the brain, the neurons actually started performing their regular metabolic functions. They were making proteins and doing all that sort of stuff. So they didn't bring the brain back to a level of consciousness. And of course, that would make some really interesting ethical problems there. But here's a brain that's been disconnected from the body, left at room temperature for 4 hours, and yet can be brought back to life. So, and of course, we have examples of sperm and eggs that have been cryo-frozen, and they're perfectly viable. And I think in terms of organs, haven't they frozen livers and, you know, in liquid nitrogen and brought them back and made and,
kidneys as well.
And kidneys, right. So if death means can't be revived, then obviously cryonics is a contradiction in terms. But if death just means meets our ordinary criteria of death, like clinical death or brain death, then it's certainly logically and physically possible to bring somebody back to life. But it certainly is possible for all the neurons to cease their normal functioning for a period of time and then, you know, be brought back to life. And that's all the cryonics needs, right? It just has to be possible to bring these neurons back to life.
Would you say that if I were to let's say where we were in the year 1800, and I told you that in 150 years we're going to be soaring through the air in tin cans, you know, cylindrical metallic tubes, hundreds of miles an hour. You know, and crossing the Atlantic and the Pacific, you know, while having a few peanuts on the way, and you would have looked at me and you would say, what you're saying is akin to a faith-based belief. You know, it's not, you have no evidence of this. And I would say, well, look at the birds. You know, the birds are doing it, and you know, I don't remember if they did had hot air balloons at all back then, but you know, we're close to doing something like being able to be lighter than air in some ways. Therefore, I can imagine a future where that's happening. And you say, maybe you can imagine it, but to believe that it would be the case might as well be, you know, you might as well be taking that on faith. There's so little evidence for the pure possibility of humans ever doing that. Is this kind of a nonsensical approach, or let's even say that there was a church of, you know, the flyers, and that church strongly believed that in 150 years there's going to be people flying. Would that taint my belief in the idea that people will fly in 150 years? You know, should I recoil at the thought of believing that in 1800?
Well, I don't know exactly how much evidence was available at that time, but I think you point to the birds, and that makes perfectly good sense. And of course, good old Leonardo da Vinci was making flying machines, you know, way back in the 1500s. So, no, I mean, I think that makes perfectly good sense. So the one type of possibility is logical possibility, and certainly cryonics is not logically impossible. So what makes something physically impossible is that it violates a law of nature, a law of science, right? So a cow jumping over the moon may be physically impossible, but it's not logically impossible because it doesn't involve a logical contradiction. But cryonics is not physically impossible. I mean, the very notion of cryonics doesn't suppose that we're going to find some new laws of nature, that we're going to have to violate some laws of nature in order for it to make it happen. I mean, so as the examples we've already discussed shows the proof of principle. I mean, so we can bring these organs back to life, even though they've ceased their functions completely.
And even more than just organs, and not in humans yet, but we have proof of concept, you know, through other organisms like the tardigrade or water bear, and certain caterpillars, that they can essentially chronically preserve themselves, albeit, you know, that's what they do naturally through evolution. But, you know, we have proof of concept in the animal world that it can be done. So it I consider that to be, you know, pretty big piece of evidence that kind of falls on the side of, you know, it logically being possible.
Right. So I think that the only sort of argument that, you know, is any sort of possibility against cryonics is that it's technologically impossible, that actually repairing all the sort of damage that would happen as the result of being cryonically frozen is going to forever be beyond our technological abilities. But, you know, I don't know that anybody can say that. So certainly if somebody is cryonically preserved immediately after death, and if we use aldehyde fixation method, which can actually preserve a brain down to the ion channel level, and the indication is that if you use that aldehyde preservation method, that no significant sort of damage happens. I mean, so it seems to me that it is possible to preserve these organs in such a way that the sort of damage that people are worried about doesn't happen. And of course, there's always the possibility that sometime in the future, which is what the original cryonicists were counting on, we're going to develop some technology that's going to be able to repair whatever damage we have. But now we have an idea of what that technology might be like. I mean, people appeal to nanomedicine and nanobots and so forth. But all the people that have been working in this sort of area from Eric Drexler, you know, through Kurzweil and all those guys, say that, you know, it is indeed possible to make little machines that can repair cellular damage. We can make little machines that are smaller than a blood cell, and we can send them through the body to the part of the body that's damaged, and we can knit those atoms and molecules back together again. And again, that doesn't violate any laws of nature, doesn't violate any laws of physics and so forth. And we have mechanisms in our bodies that do that right now. So we just have to figure out how to make these devices ourselves, and we can do that.
You know, in thinking about this question, it reminds me most of the question of intelligent extraterrestrial life, which is also a prediction, and it's also something that a lot of people find to be very weird, and it's the subject of a lot of controversy. You know, some scientists come out as saying, "Well, you know, actually, I do find SETI a worthwhile pursuit," and others say, "You're wasting your life. You're dreaming. This is crazy. Why are you pursuing this?" But it does suggest that there may also be something like a Drake equation, but for cryonics. You know, so you say, "Well, you know, the chances of us being able to develop some kind of molecular nanotechnology sufficient to be able to repair the brain." And the chances of us being able to, you know, upload, or the chances, you know, times the chances that you're going to, however long it's going to take for us to get there, and the chance that your cryotube gets struck by a meteor at some point between now and then, or the company goes out of business, you know, you multiply all these factors together, and just like the Drake equation tries to estimate the number of actively transmitting intelligent life in the galaxy, in this case the cryonics equation would estimate the number, you know, the percentage chance that you getting cryonically suspended today would end up being revived at some point in the future. But I do find it interesting how these kind of long shot predictive sorts of approaches or ways of thinking or categories of science do seem to be so weird to some people that they don't even want to, they reject it completely from being anywhere near their worldview. Perhaps you, and I know you've definitely brought these kinds of subjects up to your students and obviously to a lot of other people. Do you feel like there's a framework that philosophers use, or that scientists use, or that students use, and that these are somehow different, and you know, people don't like to think about this? What has been your experience with this, Ted?
Well, I'm always surprised at how few people even know that cryonics exists or is a possibility. I mean, I guess the shows like Twilight Zone and Outer Limits and Star Trek that all dealt with sort of these things back in the day are not as watched by as many people as they used to be, but gee, I knew that this was a possibility way back then. And I think the problem is they have no concept of it. And again, the problem is they want to know, how is this possible? And since they don't have any framework or understanding of how this might be done, they sort of, you know, reject it out of hand and say it can't happen. So, you know, what they need is a better education on what science has actually accomplished and what it looks forward to accomplish in the not too distant future. You know, I think that would help. The other, you know, you get other sorts of arguments. So this year, for example, I exposed people to the concept of chronic preservation and asked my students if they would like to do that. And the first guy to respond said, "No, I don't want to live forever because I don't want to be immortal." And of course, chronics has nothing to do with being immortal. It's just, you know, having a being alive for one more day or one more period. And if you don't like the way that things are when you wake up from your chronic suspension, you can always commit suicide. So it's not like you're being condemned to immortality or something like that. Other people say, "Oh, gee, I wouldn't know anybody. All my friends would be dead." And I said, "Well, just suppose that somebody gives all your friends the life insurance that they need in order to get chronically preserved, right? So would you do it then?" And they said, well, maybe. But other sorts of things that people worry about, they say, "Well, gee, will I be relevant back then? Will I have anything to do? Will I have any work to do? Will my skills be any good or something like that?" And I guess that's a concern. But, you know, it's entirely possible that by the time people are brought back from chronic preservation, that we may have a universal assembler to talk about nanobots again, right? So this is the ultimate goal of nanotechnology, is actually to create these little machines in which you put the raw products in, you know, the basic elements, and the machines actually knit these elements together into any device that you want to make. So Drexler proposed that back in the Engines of Creation. And there's actually a division at MIT, Bits and Atoms, in which these guys are working at it. So I don't know if you saw Kurzweil's documentary, The Singularity is Near. Of course, he wrote the book, The Singularity is Near, but then he also made a little documentary about it. And he talked to one of the graduate students that was working in the Bits and Atoms program. And so Kurzweil says, "So if I need a new toaster, what you can do is you can just send me the program for making a toaster, and I can put it into my universal assembler, and I can make a toaster." And the graduate student says, "Well, better yet, I'll just send you the program for toast. You don't need the toaster. You can just make the toast." I mean, this is what a universal assembler would allow you to do. It would allow you to make any sort of physical object that you can specify the composition of. And so... if something like that comes to happen, then, you know, we're not going to need work in the same way that we do. I mean, and then, of course, there's all sorts of other possibilities which are interesting to consider. And so, especially given Elon Musk's recent reveal of the next generation of Neuralink, right? I mean, so this really does have the prospect. And of course, this may be hundreds of years down the line, but... So suppose you are woken up from your cryo state and none of your existing skills are needed anymore. And you need some other skills if you're going to be a useful and productive member of society. Well, you just stick a neural link in your head, you download the skills, and there you go.
Matrix style there, yeah.
Yeah, right, in Matrix style. So again, I think worried about being antiquated or outmoded is not something to worry about. People worry about, you know, overpopulation and so forth. And I don't know that that is necessarily a problem. I mean, as standard of living rises in a country, the population growth goes down. So it's possible that we're not going to have a runaway population and that, you know, we're going to have enough, food and resources for these additional people when we wake them up. And then, of course, there's the other possibility. Again, if you want to go with Elon Musk, so suppose these guys are in this cryopreserved state and, we want to wake them up and let them experience what life is like now. But suppose that the physical world is too overcrowded, right? Well, we'll just make a simulated reality for them and let them live there. And if the simulated reality is as good as Musk claims it's going to be, they won't be able to tell the difference. So you could have a million people inside a
inside the matrix,
the matrix, right? So all these concerns, I don't think are necessarily problems. It does depend on developing future technology, but we'll see it when it happens. I mean, if ultimately overpopulation is a problem, then obviously they're not going to wake up the prior cryo preserves people. But if not, and we have universal assemblers, then who knows?
And Ted, since you're essentially in a unique position where you're running a somewhat of a focus group on thoughts on chronics with your students, how would you, when first introducing the subject of chronics to new students, are there any specific traits that you notice in those students who instantly take a liking to the concept? And alternatively, are there any traits you notice in students who immediately are off-put by the idea?
Well, that's a good question. I think that the people that take to it are really some people that have had some exposure to it. I think when people hear it for the first time, if they've never encountered anything like this or don't know about the possibility of mind uploading, and of course there are fewer and fewer people like that around these days, but it's still the case. I would say, gee, even with transcendence and even with matrix and all that sort of stuff, I would say a good half of the students that I see anyway had no idea that mind uploading is even a possibility. You would think that they would. I mean, one of the most remarkable things, I was talking to a newly minted PhD in the psychology department, and I told him that we were going to discuss functionalism, which is the theory of mind that lies behind mind uploading. And this guy had never even heard of it. And this guy was a social psychologist, so he didn't worry himself with questions like, what is it to have a mind? What is it to be in a mental state? But gee, you would think that if somebody went all the way through a psychology PhD, they would have been exposed to at least the dominant theory of mind in cognitive science. Or
that at least have the curiosity to have, ask the question and done their own research,
Yeah. Right. So people just don't do that sort of stuff. I think that there still is, I think a lot of psychology majors are under the impression that the scientific view of the mind is that the mind is the brain, and so the idea is that once the brain ceases to function, you cease to exist, or once the brain dies, you die. But of course, that's not the theory of mind that underlies work in artificial intelligence and cognitive science in general, right? That the theory of functionalism is that it's not that the mind is the brain, but the mind is what the brain does. It's the function it performs. And so the sort of analogy that's usually given is that the mind is to the brain as the software of a computer is to its hardware. So the mind isn't the brain, the mind is the program running on the brain. And as we know about programs, you can take that program and you can run it on different computers. You can take Microsoft Word and run it on a Mac or run it on a PC, right? So, and of course, this is what Kurzweil is all about. He says, eventually, what we should be able to do is decode the program that's running on your brain and get it up and running on a computer that has similar power. And I think he says that the date is 2045, right?
Yeah, it's a running date. It's
a running date.
He has I believe on his website, or he keeps track of his predictions and how they're coming to fruition. And for the most part, he's pretty close to the original predictions, but
is he still sticking with 2045?
I can't remember exactly. I think it might have jumped up to 2050. That being said, I mean, more than most other people in this realm, he's making much harder predictions and much sooner predictions than everybody else. So, right. his confidence in his predictions is quite infectious. So I tend to kind of go with his beliefs in those dates, which gives me a lot of hope, because I don't have to wait around that long for them to,
right,
be proven.
Well, you guys will probably make it to 2045. I don't know if I'm going to make it, but we'll see what happens.
well, Ted, there certainly is at least one way to try.
That's right. Okay.
That's right. We have a backup plan for you.
We have a plan B. So I want to dig a little bit into this question of identity, consciousness, and what we're really trying to preserve here, because like you said, our mind is what the brain is doing right now, but presumably in some future, our mind could also be what some other thing is doing, some other sort of substrate, right. Something digital or what have you. However, when I think of a subject like cryonics, and I think of what are some of the ways in which I could be potentially revived in the future, one scenario is the nanotech scenario where, you know, a bunch of nanobots run through my head and repair the damage that's been done to my neurons and you know, the synapses and everything else, and essentially put it back the way it was the moment before I started going under cryopreservation. And shock me, and you know, I come back to life, and everything's fine. And my conscious experience of that would be, you know, I'm laying in the bed. They're like, okay, it's, you know, it's you're about to go. And then I close my eyes, wake, open my eyes, and they're like, hey, here you are. You know, everything's great. You're fine. Your brain is fine. Oh, by the way, we've gone through the trouble of, you know, boosting your immune system and repairing all your cells and rejuvenating you and blah blah blah. Okay, that's one scenario. But the scenario where instead of them doing that, what they do is they scan my brain by essentially destroying it. You know, they take a bunch of cross sections of my brain and they figure out where all the positions of my neurons are and how they're all linked and how everything's connected, and they recreate that on in a computer somewhere, and I no longer have any kind of wetware. You know, there's nothing traditionally physical about my body or my existence. That doesn't sit very well with me. You know, there's something about that feels uncomfortable. You know, I don't like that idea. It feels like there's something very valuable that is lost. You know, that there's something that I wanted to preserve. It's better than nothing, perhaps, but there's something that I wanted to preserve that would now be gone. And this is the mind uploading scenario. So how do we think about that? Is my gut reaction to be uncomfortable with that just wrong, you know, just a bad intuition, or is it a good, healthy intuition? You know, where should I be going with that?
Well, I think it is sort of a common intuition that people have. And I think it's one of the reasons that they think, for example, robots who are made out of silicon and steel instead of carbon and oxygen and so forth would not be able to have a mind or to be conscious. You know, we sort of have this notion that consciousness requires a biologically living thing. But of course, biologically living things are made out of the same protons, neutrons, and electrons that the computers are made out of. So in terms of the ultimate stuff, we're really not that different. And so I guess it ultimately depends on, you know, can this stuff really perform all the same sort of functions that your brain originally performed? And actually, I guess I should say, I am not a functionalist in the traditional sense. So the functionalist is somebody who wants to define something in terms of its input and an output. So, you know, mathematical function, you take a certain input and it produces a certain output. So for the functionalist, what they want to claim is, you know, as long as the computer is producing the right output given the right input, well, then you've got, say, a brain, or you've got a brain that can produce a mind. Well, the most popular theory of consciousness now actually rejects functionalism. So it's a theory called integrated information theory. And I don't know if you've heard about this from Tononi and Koch and so forth. Max Tegmark is a proponent of this theory. And basically what it says is that the actual structure of the computer itself matters. So if all you have is a feed forward system where, you know, you give certain input and the information is passed, you know, up through the levels and you produce a certain output, well, that's one way to get certain output. But what makes our brains unique and what is responsible for our conscious experience, these guys say, are really all the feedback loops that are built into our brain. And so our brain is not just a feed forward network. The brain is actually integrating this information in all sorts of ways. So I think that they're right about it. I mean, there's just too many objections to functionalism as it's, you know, traditionally been conceived for it to work. But this is not to say that you couldn't have a computer with a mind. It's just to say that in order to have a mind, you have to do more than just run the right sort of program. what you have to do is you have to run it on the right sort of hardware. That is where the hardware itself is wired in the right sort of ways. So it doesn't throw any water on the possibility of cryonics, but I think it means that, you know, if our brains are ultimately going to be uploaded and if integrated information theory is right, then we want to make sure that we get uploaded onto something that has the same sort of internal architecture as our brain. So the integrated information guys have some really interesting results to their theory. So they can actually tell whether or not someone is conscious by sending a pulse through their brain and seeing how the pulse is actually integrated in the brain and how it sort of vibrates through the brain. This was published in Scientific American a few years back. Of course, the original research was published someplace else, but they call it the consciousness meter. And so people worry about whether or not, for example, you're going to be able to tell that a robot is conscious, you know, like an ex machina, is Eva conscious? Well, if integrated information theory is true, we could tell if Eva's conscious. We just have to open her brain up and see what the architecture looks like. So if she has the right sort of feedback loops in there, then indeed she would be conscious.
How do we know we didn't just discover one way of being conscious and there aren't, 50 other ways of being conscious?
Absolutely. I mean, that's entirely possible. And actually, that's what functionalism was based on, is multiple realizability, that the idea that brains can be realized in things, or that minds can be realized in things other than brains, that they could be realized into computers. Or if some creature on some faraway planet has a different evolutionary history, maybe their life is based on silicon rather than carbon, so they might have an entirely different evolutionary history and physical structure than we do. But it's possible that they might be conscious too. I mean, so one of the interesting things about integrated information theory is that it does open the door to a form of panpsychism. So they say wherever there's integrated information, there's consciousness, right? So they're actually committed to the view that, gee, if plants are integrating information in the right sort of ways, then they might have some level of consciousness. They're certainly not going to be self-conscious like we are, but they might have some sort of consciousness. So interestingly enough, according to this theory, consciousness may not just be something that's possessed by mammals and vertebrates, that might even go down farther than that.
And with, in this subject, we're talking about the brain specifically, kind of ignoring the body, but with both mind uploading and the neuro-only cryonics procedure, the physical body from the neck down is essentially abandoned. Do you think there's any reason to believe that the body, aside from your brain, contains portions of your identity, or are these, or is it all up here?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question. I mean, so if it seems to you as if you have a body, so if from the inside it feels to you exactly the way you feel now, for example, I don't know that it matters that you really do have a body, right? So if the simulation is so good that it seems that you're moving your arms, it seems that you're getting sensations from your eyes and your ears and your nose and all that sort of stuff, then I think you're okay. So I think that to lead the sort of lives that we lead, we have to feel as if we have a body. And I think that a robot body could be made to feel that way as well. So we certainly do need sensations, I think, to be normal. If you're not receiving sensations from the parts of your body, you start hallucinating, right? Yeah. We all know that. So you do need inputs of that sort, but I don't know that the inputs have to come from flesh and blood. I think we could make prostheses that produce the same sort of inputs that would feel the same from the inside. And of course, that's what matters.
Yeah, I know people often, discuss the concept of making decisions from the heart or the gut, and would you say that potentially there could be some distributed information processing somewhere in the body? I I'm guessing it's primarily in the brain, or not guessing, it's primarily in the brain. But I'm wondering if these kind of, are these just colloquial ways of describing the brain's interaction with the body, or could there be any truth to the idea of processing in other portions of the body aside from the brain that make up our identity?
I know a lot of people. Sorry. Daniel, I think you're also referring to the fact that some people talk about the like the gut bacteria and the gut biome having an impact on thinking in various ways, through neurochemical transmitters that are produced in larger or smaller quantities, serotonin within other parts of the body, et cetera. And, you know, would you have to basically fake all of that or reproduce all of that in order for whatever gets spat out the other side to be recognizably you or recognizably human or something like that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And they do seem to have a profound impact on all sorts of aspects of our mental life. So I guess if we're going to duplicate the sort of mental life we have now without gut bacteria, we're going to have something that simulates the sort of input that those bacteria give to our brain right now.
So that's interesting because, what that means is that although probably the primary focus is going to be on the brain, we do somewhat have to understand the brain's interaction with the rest of our body to know what inputs and outputs to manipulate, presuming we were either creating, a digital version or an uploaded version of ourselves. If we wanted to be true to our pure identity, however you would define that.
Right.
Maybe what that means is all the people who are currently being preserved only as neuro patients, where essentially the head is the only thing that's being preserved. Maybe when they come back, they won't really be them. They'll be since they'll be missing all these
the gut bacteria
and these other feedback mechanisms. And if we won't have the information to reverse engineer what those feedback mechanisms were in the case of any given individual, we may not. We'll bring somebody back who's maybe very close to them, but missing some crucial aspect of their personality or their experience or something. I guess that's all the more reason to keep the whole body on ice as opposed to just the head.
Right. I mean, it sounds like an interesting research program there.
Yeah. With a very long time horizon.
I don't know how you do the controlled experiments though. Do you kill off somebody's gut bacteria and see what happens to them? And, who's going to do that sort of stuff?
Might be hard to get IRB approval for that one.
Yeah, right. Exactly. But it is an interesting question. So, another aspect of this, which comes up from time to time, and there was actually one student this year that sort of took this view, and that is that, your soul wouldn't go with you, right? So we have the whole soul notion that what makes you is not your body, not your brain, not even the program that's running on your brain, but this other sort of thing, this immaterial thing, this soul. And how do we know whether or not that's going to go along? Unfortunately, because there's no way to detect the soul. I mean, it's sort of one of the classic unfalsifiability things. It's one of the things that the early empiricists like David Hume said was really a meaningless concept because it couldn't be derived from any sort of sense experience at all. Because, of course, there's no way to sense a soul.
Well, but, I think they did try to weigh the soul at one point.
there was a guy who claimed to have found some measurements, right? But those nobody was able to duplicate that, and so what he was measuring was something else, interestingly enough. But but there's one aspect of this too, which is sort of a remarkable aspect of the educational system in general, and seminaries in particular, is that the Bible gives us no reason for believing in an immortal soul. And what's remarkable about this is that biblical scholars are unanimously agreed on this, that the Bible gives us no reason for believing in an immortal soul. So, where does this immortal soul doctrine come from then? Well, everybody who knows their intellectual history knows that it actually comes from Plato. So if you think that you have a soul, which when you die is, say, going to go to heaven or go to hell, you are not a Bible-believing Christian or Jew. You are a follower of Plato. Let me read you something here, if I can find this. If you go to Wikipedia and you look up the entry Christian Mortalism, the last paragraph, you know, says it. But this is from a book called Persons and Personality. And it says, there appears to be a rare unanimity among biblical scholars that the biblical picture of the person is non-dualist. So dualism is a view that the mind and the body are separate and that each can exist independently of the other. So there's a unanimity among biblical scholars that the biblical picture of the person is non-dualist and that the Bible gives little or no support to the idea that a person is essentially a soul or that the soul is separable from the body. Dualists, of course, may reply that regardless of what the Bible said about the issue then, dualism offers a convincing framework for Christian teaching now. Even so, they cannot get around the fact that from a biblical point of view, dualism is very odd. So Linda Silva summarizes the position thus. This is another biblical scholar. He says, biblical scholarship has established quite conclusively, this is not tentatively, it's not approximately, provisionally, it's established quite conclusively that there's no dichotomous concept of man in the Bible, such as is found in Greek and Hindu thought. The biblical view of man is holistic, not dualistic. The notion of the soul as an immortal entity which enters the body at birth and leaves it at death is quite foreign to the biblical view of man. The biblical view is that man is a unity. He's a unity of soul, body, flesh, and mind, all together constituting the whole man. None of the constituent elements is capable of separating itself from the total structure and continuing to live after death. Well, so did you know that that's the official position of the Bible scholars, unanimously agreed upon by the Bible scholars?
Well, are you postulating that highly religious people are able to be extremely inconsistent in their beliefs?
No, I'm remarkable to me that, I mean, that this is the consensus now, but it's not taught in Sunday schools. It's not taught in church. And so, you know, when I have dinners with ministers and priests and rabbis, which I had the opportunity to do a number of times, I would usually ask them, well, did you know that biblical scholars unanimously agree that there is no such thing as a mortal soul? And they'll go, psh, everybody knows that, you know, that's all old news. And then I said, well, do you tell your congregation? And I had two say to my face, oh, I would never tell them that. They'd stop coming. I mean, so this is a story. It's a story they know is not in the Bible, but it's a story that they continue to tell because it puts people in the seats. But the notion that there is this soul that somehow can exist independently of the body, that is somehow our essence, is not to be found in the Bible at all. So then the question arises, all right, but gee, doesn't the Bible say if you believe in Jesus Christ, you get eternal life, right? Well, so if there is no eternal soul, how do you get eternal life?
I've actually encountered someone who was interested in chronics and was both religious and kind of alternately to denying that the soul left the body or couldn't. He actually believed that the soul was in the brain. So it was a more of a rationalization because he was clever enough to realize the brain is the hub of things. But in order to, I guess, retain some consistency of, you know, identity and belief, he said, well, the soul is literally resides physically in the brain. And therefore, if we preserve the brain, we're preserving the soul. So there are ways to rationalize these kind of seemingly impossible, you know, beliefs.
Right. And so I think that, so actually the guy who invented the concept of mind uploading, Hans Moravec, was sort of clear about this. And, but so for him, the soul actually is the program that's running on your brain. You know, the program that running is on your brain is what makes you, you. It's, guides your thoughts and your decisions and your actions and all that sort of stuff. And so as long as that program is preserved, you're preserved. So again, to get back to the question of how Christians are supposed to get eternal life, I mean, it's just remarkable that this is like the basic teaching of Christianity, and very few Christians that I've ever met really understand it. I mean, so, you know, when it says in the Nicene Creed and the Apostolic Creed, I believe in the resurrection, doesn't mean I believe that Jesus was resurrected. It means that I believe that on Judgment Day, you know, the good are going to be resurrected. So the way that you get eternal life, according to Christianity, is the way that Jesus got eternal life. Your body gets resurrected.
Maybe that's what we're really doing here with cryonics. You know, we're
You're doing God's work.
We're the Knights Templar or something. You know, we're out there fighting for the for the resurrection. What do you think, Ted, about this notion? I've heard this that we're sort of natural born dualists. You know, and so we instinctively, you know, from the womb, we have this, you know, we suddenly discover this theory of mind. You know, oh, I have my mind in my head, and other people have other minds in their heads. And, you know, it's not until we're like 2 or 3 or 4 or something when we develop this. And then so that causes us to have this sense that there is this body and there's this separate thing called the mind or the soul or the whatever you want to call it. And so the reason why Christianity sort of took on this belief is because it just, it's such a natural fit, you know, that religion, that people's worldviews are going to incorporate some kind of dualistic notion, unless they very specifically, you know, have a reason not to be dualists. They're just going to naturally be dualists. So it's where Christianity was going to fall into anyway.
Right. Well, I think that that's, you know, absolutely right. I think people are natural born dualists. And I think it is remarkable that the writers of the Bible were not dualists. I mean, so they really thought that your only chance to live again is if your body lives again. I mean, they thought that your body is essential to you. So like you, Max, they would say, you know, your body's got to get resurrected if you're going to get resurrected. So even though that's the case, I think what you can make people realize is that at least in terms of the traditional way that, say, the soul is conceived, it can't possibly be what makes you you. Your soul can't be your essence. So the soul is supposed to be this eternal, immortal entity that you know, comes into your body at conception, say, and leaves it at death. But the soul is not a thought. The soul is something that has thoughts. So the relationship between the soul and its thoughts is like the relationship between a pincushion and its pins, right? So the soul stays the same, but the pins can come and go. So you have a whole different set of beliefs, attitudes, and desires than you had, say, when you were in kindergarten, but the soul theory has a ready explanation for that. It says, well, yeah, even though you have a whole different set of beliefs, attitudes, and desires, they inhere in the same thing, inhere in this spiritual substance, this immaterial soul. And as long as that remains the same, then you continue to exist. But what's interesting is that the philosophers, you know, of the Enlightenment rejected that view. So Leibniz, for example, the guy who whose calculus we use to this day, Newton invented a version of the calculus, but we don't use Newton's calculus. I mean, he was a smart guy. He knew what he was talking about. But he said, you know, it certainly can't be the case that we can identify the soul with yourself. And so this was a Leibniz's way of putting this theory to the test. He said, now suppose that someone comes up to you and offers to make you the richest person in the world. He used the example of the king of China, who at that time was considered to be the richest person in the world. But so suppose that somebody comes up to you and says, here, I'll give you $200 billion. He said, wow, that sounds good. What do I have to do? He says, all you have to do is let me erase all of your memories. So you won't know who you are. You won't know, you know, who your friends are. You won't have any of the skills that you acquired over time. You won't remember any of the thing that you did. And so then the question, of course, arises, will you be around to use that $200 billion? And Leibniz said no. And so even though your soul would be around, you know, all we're going to do is we're just going to take the pins out of the pincushion. We're just going to take the pins out of the soul. It's not going to be the case that you're going to be around. So what that means then is, having the same soul is not sufficient for being who you are. You know, because your soul can still exist and you can cease to exist. For example, if you got total amnesia. So if what cryonics does is erase all your memories, then of course there's no reason to get cryonically preserved, right? So we have to hope that when they preserve these brains, they're preserving them in fine enough detail that all your memories and attitudes and beliefs and so forth are preserved. But so not only is the soul not sufficient, it's not necessary either. And John Locke had an example of that. He said, now suppose that acts the soul in your body right now that has all your thoughts and feelings and desires, the pincushion that has all these pins that make you up. Suppose that was the soul that Nestor had at the battle of Troy. Right? So does that make you identical to Nestor? He says, no. Right? So even if it is the exact same spiritual substance that held Nestor's thoughts, that doesn't make you identical to Nestor. So your soul is neither necessary nor sufficient for being you. It can't possibly be your essence. It can't be what makes you you. So whether or not your soul is preserved is totally irrelevant.
That's not that different from the belief in reincarnation, in, you know, which your, you know, quote unquote soul is, you know, reincarnated into someone else with none of your memories, and but somehow it's still the essence of you being transferred from one place to another. Which,
right. Although the Hindus and the Buddhists, though, would say that those memories are there. They're just not available, you know, to be consciously recalled. But if you do the right sort of meditation exercises and engage in the right sort of discipline, you can bring those memories back to consciousness. So the Hindu adepts actually claim to be able to remember their past lives because the memories are there. It's just that you just can't recall them immediately.
And aside from it being very interesting, would you say there's any particular benefit from, I guess, comparing, you know, the science of chronics to, you know, the belief in religion, or is it purely an academic exercise?
Right. No, I think it's just a belief in the future. It's just somebody who has hope. And if somebody really does want to see what life is like in the future, it seems to be a perfectly reasonable thing to do. So suppose that the chances are really, really slim that it's going to happen. We know that if you don't get chronically preserved, then there's no chance, right? And so, you know, one example that sometimes people use, suppose that you're on the fifth story of a burning building, right? And you know that there's very little chance that the firemen are going to get there before the building collapses. Is it irrational to call 911? I would think even if you thought that there was a really slim chance that they were going to get there in time, you'd still call 911, right? So even if the possibility for the success of chronics is really small, I don't think that makes it irrational.
I was going to say, at least in my belief, and I'm guessing Max shares the same belief, you know, anything above zero is, in terms of chances, is infinitely better than the certainty of death.
Right.
So we don't need huge numbers to you know, want to follow this path.
Right.
I do think if the numbers are very, very, very slim, then it goes back into not making very much sense. But they'd have to, you know, but I don't think they're nearly that slim. But there is something I wanted to ask you, Ted. Getting a little bit back to this question of when you get uploaded, that the wetware that constitutes my brain is of course something I'm perfectly happy with at the moment. But the idea of running whatever I am on some other substrate, like we've discussed, you know, seems possible and seems totally fine. And that doesn't necessarily worry me too much. What worries me is that it's somehow that even though some particular substrate may be running a program that is for all intents and purposes seems like me, it can tell you about the time when I was 12 and I stubbed my toe, and it can talk about how great it was to be, you know, in philosophy of science class with you and how I learned about the ideas and in every way, shape and form, it seems to be me. Yet I still feel somehow uncomfortable if, it is essentially, a copy of me, right? It's not, something in me and my intuitions around this are always breaking down and I always go one way or another. But the idea of my brain being scanned, you know, molecule by molecule, and then reproduced on digital substrate, or even in a physical substrate, even regrown, you know, perfectly atom by atom, and then so being, you know, wetware. Something about that just still doesn't sit right. It doesn't seem like it's really going to be me. Or heck, what if it's copied in this way 100 times? You know, and now there's 100 versions of me. So going back, of course, to what you're describing as the soul and all this, maybe I have some kind of, antiquated or dualistic notion of my soul. And I feel like there really is something lost because there's some fundamental continuity of my stream of consciousness that is obviously not going to be continuous for the 1,000 years I'm waiting for this to happen. Am I mistaken here?
You're exactly right. And you hit upon a really important concept that, you know, a lot of writers, in transhumanism and so forth, don't understand. Max Moore understands it. I think he actually did his PhD thesis on personal identity. But the important thing to realize is that there's really two types of identity. So there's numerical identity. And so something is numerical if it's one and the same as something else. So Mark Twain and Samuel Clemens are numerically identical because they're one and the same guy. You know, so there aren't two separate people. There's just two names for the same guy. But take, you know, any number of pressings of, say, a CD, right? So each pressing is numerically different from every other pressing, but nonetheless, they're all qualitatively identical. So the two types of identity are numerical identity, you know, which is a one-to-one relationship, and then there's qualitative identity, which is a one-to-many relationship. So many different objects can be qualitatively identical to one another. And I think you're right that what you get with a mind upload is you don't get numerical identity. And so the question is, does that matter? And that really was the central question in the problem of personal identity. People were trying to come up with a theory of numerical identity that would explain, in virtue of what a person at one time is numerically identical to a person at another time. And they would use things like memory and personality and all that sort of stuff. But ultimately, all of the theories that people came up with failed. And so the sort of view that has become, I guess, most prevalent in theories of personal identity is called the psychological continuity view, which says that, if you have psychological continuity, you have really all that matters, but you don't have numerical identity. So all of your copies would be psychologically continuous with you. They would have all the same memories. They would have all the same beliefs, attitudes, and desires, all the same personality characteristics and so forth. But you're right. They would be copies. They wouldn't be you. But the way that Parfit puts it, although they wouldn't be you, being psychologically continuous with you is better than just dying. So they would all think that you're you. I mean, so they would all have the same thoughts, feelings, desires, beliefs, attitudes, and all that sort of stuff. But it does raise interesting sort of questions. So the first person to formulate a theory of personal identity was Locke. And the reason he formulated it is because he realized that if we're going to have a fair justice system, we want to make sure that the person that we're throwing in jail is the person that committed the crime. And he realized, well, we couldn't just go on bodily similarity alone, you know, because of twins and stuff like that. And so he came up with the memory theory. But it does raise interesting sort of questions for an upload. I mean, so if you are uploaded, I think it really is fair to say that you are not numerically identical to the original, especially if you do it in terms of a replicator. So one way to conceive of a replicator is that we scan you, we find where all your atoms are related to each other. We send that information to a device that takes another bin full of different sorts of atoms and knits them back together into the same sort of configuration that yours were in. So actually, that's not the way that the Star Trek transporter works. works. So believe it or not, there is a Star Trek technical manual that actually indicates how this stuff works, and they would give it to the writers of Star Trek episodes so everybody would be on the same page. So supposedly what happens in the Star Trek replicator is you're subatomically debonded, and then the very particles that make you up are sent to the destination and somehow put back together. So it's not like, you know, we scan you, leave the particles that made you up on the transporter pad, find a different set of particles and put them together. It's actually that we send the very particles that make you up. So I think that a Star Trek transporter would preserve numerical identity. So the person that stepped on the transporter pad would be numerically identical to the guy who ended up at the planet, because, you know, he's got not only the same memories and beliefs and attitudes and desires, but he's got the very same atoms that made him up before. But in the other sort of replicator where we're using a different set of atoms, you know, I think it's clear that it's just a copy of you. And I guess what makes it clear is that suppose that the scan is non-destructive, right? So we scan you like a copy machine, right? We find out how your atoms are put together. We send that information to the replicator and we make another version of you. Obviously, the replicated version is not you. You know, it's not numerically identical to you because the original you is still there. And even if we kill the original you, it's still not numerically identical to you. It's still just a copy. So I think that it is just a copy. But of course, at that point, they're different persons. They all start having different experiences. There are many different versions of you at that point. But they do all have your same history. So I think the interesting sort of question is, so what happens if you go through one of these replicators that makes copies of you using different atoms? And we found out that the original committed a crime. Do we lock them all up? Even though none of them are numerically identical to the original, would this be an argument you could use in court? Well, you can't arrest me. I'm not numerically identical to the guy that just committed the crime. I'm only a copy.
And well, what if there's 10 copies? Do we put them all in jail?
Yeah, I think you'd have to put them all in jail, right? I think you would. So the way that Parfit puts it is identity is not what matters for survival. So in order for you to survive, you don't have to be numerically identical to the thing that survives. You just have to be psychologically continuous. And if you're psychologically continuous, you've got all that matters.
Well, is there any way I can think about this that would kind of assuage my anxiety about this? Because the whole premise of copies, and like you're saying, they might be, you know, similar, but they're not you. And you said, well, at least it's better than nothing. But is it? If my conception of dying is that, you know, my localized consciousness is all that matters, you know, and I can be existent with another copy of me, that doesn't mean I'm okay killing myself. I'm still, you know, I still have my own survival instinct within my own localized consciousness. So is there a way we can have our cake and eat it too with this, or are our minds just not really designed to think about these, you know, weird scenarios in which, you know, have no bearing on our, you know, evolved, you know, self?
Right. Well, I think Max is right. I mean, so if the full body is restored, then you're numerically identical to the original, right? So if your full body and your brain is restored, then there's no question, there's no copy. You're restored, you're numerically identical to the guy that, you know, died. So that would work. But you're right, all the neuro patients, the best that they can look for is qualitative identity as opposed to numerical identity. But again, according to Parfit, that's better than nothing.
I suppose in theory, I've thought of a little bit about this, but in theory, you could take a neuro patient and you could do it like Futurama. You know, you could have their heads somehow connected to a device which allows them to continue to exist even though they don't have a body, or you could, you know, connect their body into some kind of cybernetic body or something. Or heck, you could even take a few cells out of their, you know, skin cheek or something, regrow their physical body. Genetically, it would be them.
Right.
And then reattach their head to their now regrown own physical body. I mean, so presumably when you grow this new body, you would grow it without a head or without a brain, or you'd, I don't know, throw the brain out. I don't know what you do. But, you know, some way that you could, as a neuro patient, still come back and have a physical body, or a, whether it's biological or not is, you know, separate. But yeah, I feel like this question of, is it the same atoms? You know, if I intuitively or psychologically feel like insisting on it being the same atoms, this makes me feel like I'm somehow, like I believe there's a soul somehow trapped in those atoms, or, you know, trapped in the configuration of those specific atoms. And in physics, I mean, we're taught that one atom, as long as it has exactly the same properties of spin and charge and et cetera, it, there is no difference functionally right. between one atom and the other. And so right. it seems strange to me. It seems like I'm clinging on to some, like Daniel was saying, some weird evolved sense in which my brain just refuses to believe that, doesn't like to die, and thinks of myself in such a terms of my body and my brain being integral to that, that it doesn't, you know, it wants to reject the idea of using different atoms or whatever. But is that just a flaw? You know, is that a flaw in our intuitions here? You know, where something like philosophy can help us think about this more clearly?
Yeah, I don't think it's a flaw. I mean, I think that if numerical identity is what you want, then you have to pretty much have the same sort of atoms. Now, of course, you get a different set of atoms every 7 years. So yep. supposedly none of the atoms that were in your body, even in your brain, are not the same that they were 7 years ago. And other people I've heard say that that happens even faster than that. But, you know, so in a sense, we're all going through slow transporter trips our entire lives. But I think that atoms are important. And I think, you know, see, if I was a Christian minister, you know, that's what I would be advertising, is that the only real way for you yourself, someone that's numerically identical to you, to live again, is to be resurrected. We offer you the chance to live again. None of these other religions do that. They just give you a qualitative identity. We're resurrecting the body, and you got to have the same body to be you. So the other thing is, too, that I think it's important to say is that, so what makes our life what it is, of course, is our conscious experience. It's our sensations and it's our emotions, what it feels like from the inside. Now, this integrated information theory says that having that qualitative experience is a function of how this information is produced. But, you know, that remains to be proven. I mean, it is entirely possible that in order to have the sort of sensations that we have, you have to be made out of the right sort of stuff. I mean, so, you know, we can't totally dismiss that out of hand at this point. It may turn out to be wrong, but no one has proven it to be wrong. So it may be the case that if you want smells and tastes and touches and pain and love and so forth to feel the way that it feels to you now, you do have to have a flesh and blood body. I mean, that's a possibility. But, you know, there's ways to deal with it, like you mentioned. I mean, you could have your body cloned, right? And so you could have your body cloned and your, you know, which would include your brain, right? So we'll just make a complete copy of you with the brain, and then we'll just take the program that's, you know, encoded in the frozen brain, say, and we'll take that and we'll put it up on the cloned body. You know, it will have your flesh and blood. It won't be, again, the body will not be numerically identical to your body, but it will be qualitatively identical. And at least from the inside, it would feel exactly the same, because it would be produced by the same sort of stuff. And, you know, there's a religion that believes that. I mean, so this is a religion that gained some popularity right when cloning came into existence. It's called the Raelian religion. Do you know about these guys?
No, I don't.
So it's spelled R-A-E-L. And so Rael was a French automotive journalist. He drove racing cars. And the story is that he was walking around the edge of some extinct volcano in France, and he was visited by aliens from outer space. And the aliens told him why human beings exist. So it turns out that we are actually a science experiment by these aliens from outer space. They wanted to see, you know, what would happen if they put certain sorts of proteins and chemicals in certain sorts of circumstances and all that sort of stuff. And we're the result of their science experiment. And his religion is based on the view that they're going to come back and they're going to share their technology with us. But part of that technology is cloning technology. And the other part of that technology is learning how to get your memories and your personality and your character and so forth off of your brain and up into your clone. So the members of the Raelian cult think that they're going to be immortal by cloning themselves and have the information stored in their brain transferred to their clone.
That's actually interesting. It's not so different. It's kind of a more simplistic version of simulation hypothesis.
Right.
Where, and, you know, in their example, you know, it's, you know, the aliens have seeded us and they're, you know, watching us and kind of, but our more tech version of simulation hypothesis kind of follows the same lines.
And, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger made a movie about this. So I don't know if he was influenced by the Raelians or not, but The Sixth Day, have you ever seen The Sixth Day? So this is where Arnold Schwarzenegger is cloned. So what happens is, so rich people get syncorded. So what happens is they record the information on their brain so that if they die, then they take that information and they get it up and running on a clone of you so that you get to live again. So it's a great movie if you haven't seen it. You know, it's everyone thinks that Total Recall is so great, and Total Recall is great. But Sixth Day is a very interesting movie, too. And so they've got these stem cell things called blanks that are sort of hanging on a conveyor belt. And so when somebody dies, they take this syncording, which they do by flashing, you know, going through in through the eyeball and recording all the information that's in the brain through the eyeballs. And then they take this blank and they put the information from the syncording into the blank and they mature the blank. And of course, this can happen in a matter of hours or minutes. And you have a full grown person. And so, of course, what happened is they accidentally cloned Arnold, and you don't want two versions of Arnold running around at the same time.
just one is more than enough, I suppose.
Yeah, that's right.
Yep. And I think there's some show right now on Netflix, I forget the name of it, but where people can be essentially, their minds can be essentially uploaded into other people. And so it's a completely different genetically, completely different body, et cetera. It's, you know, I think you take like, you know, you take a prisoner or something, you know, somebody who otherwise has lost the right to have control over their own mind, and you basically delete or dump out or erase everything that was already there. And you inject it with your own. It
right.
Sounds pretty dystopian, of course, but you know, there's all kinds of those ideas.
Right. I think another movie like that was Selfless, with, the famous actor, and I can't think of his name right now, but yeah, it was the same sort of thing, that he was getting old, and so they found a young person and they tried to erase his memories, but of course, you know, the problem was that it wasn't a complete erasure, and so then you get all the problems.
Two people, two minds in one, you know, or
right
now we're not dualists, we're trialists or whatever,
right?
Something like that. This is interesting because this actually comes up in real present day cryonics research, which is there's some people who are researching the idea of cryonics preservation techniques that would basically glue I think Robert McIntyre is one of these, but they would basically glue the brain's structures together, the brain cells and you know, the neurons and the synapse, everything. It's kind of like turned into a it's not just vitrified and turned into a glass, which is typical,
right?
But it's actually turned into one continuous substance through some sort of gluing procedure. I forget exactly what it's called, but
right.
That procedure seems, from as described by the proponents of it, would be far, far, far more difficult to be able to bring you out of it, you know, sort of like turn the brain back on, than
right.
the normal vitrification procedure, which is already hard enough.
Right.
But it would preserve brain structures today a lot right. better than our current best practices when it comes to traditional vitrification techniques. And the proponent of this, so at least the one that I have heard from, has said that that's perfectly okay because he has no interest whatsoever in preserving the brain itself. All he wants is to preserve exactly the structure so that he can do mind uploading in the future, because that's what really counts.
Right.
And I've spoken to him about this, and I say, you know, doesn't this bother you? Don't you have some intuition where, you know, there's something that you wanted to preserve that's really you, that's going to be gone when you're uploaded? And he's like, no, that doesn't bother me in the slightest. And it's there where we have these kind of clashes of intuitions, where to me that bothers me, and to him that doesn't bother him at all. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe this numerical identity shouldn't matter. And it's a flaw, you know, so we really should be pursuing these other kinds of approaches that don't care about numerical identity at all. And that's the kind of, you know, cryonics preservation that we should be doing. That's where my concern comes from.
Right. So, you know, there's actually in one of Brian Greene's NOVA programs or NPR programs on quantum mechanics and so forth, where I don't know which one it is, but they do a form of transportation, teletransportation, with individual particles and individual atoms and all that sort of stuff now, in which what they do is they scan the particle and they identify its quantum state, and then they put another particle at some distance in the exact same quantum state. And so Brian Greene actually has a little video of what this would be like with regard to human beings. Right. And so he's going from New York to France. And so he gets into the tube and they scan in and find out, you know, how all those particles are put together. And of course, what's left down there is a bunch of subatomically debonded matter just lying in a heap on the floor there. And this other set of particles then receives the information and is put back together in the same way that he was over in New York. And then they ask some of the physicists, you know, would you use this transporter if it really was developed? And, you know, some of them say, sure, there's really no difference. You know, it's going to have all the same properties as me. Why should I care? And then others say, I'm not stepping into that transporter. You know, so this is something that people don't agree on, you know, that you can have very strong intuitions either way. And no one, I don't think, can say whose intuitions are better or stronger or more reasonable than the other person's.
Well, Ted, you're saying you're not going to be able to completely resolve all these matters today. You know? I know Daniel. I know you've actually lost some sleep over this subject. So that's
yeah. Well, the in terms of mind uploading and the premise that most, I mean, in general, I'm extremely positive about it, and you know, regardless of the unanswered questions of identity and such, I maintain a generally positive view that it's, like you said, better than the alternative. That being said, there's one scenario in which I, you know, particularly feel, and it's the concept of, you know, I would use the term virtual hell. And you know, mostly in chronics, we're, you know, talking about the positive side of the utopia we'll wake up in, and or if we're mind uploaded, the utopia that we'll be potentially be in. But theoretically, if you can be in a utopia, you know, some virtual utopia, there's also the alternative, which you could be in a virtual dystopia, or, you know, a virtual hell, so to speak. Now, what reason do we have to believe it's more likely we'll be in one or the other? And I guess, does this have any kind of correlation with kind of theological thinking of heaven and hell? Is this some inherent feeling we have within us? Or, I mean, in my conception, it feels very logical, but it starts to really sound like, you know, Christianity or a lot of the other religions with the, you know, the light and the dark and these kinds of things. But it does scare me because it's not a zero possibility. So I guess I'm wondering how, if there's a way to feel more comfortable about that other than just hoping for that it turns out to be one or the other.
Right. Well, so I guess you have to ask, you know, what's the motivation of these guys bringing you out of cryopreservation? So is it their feeling that, you know, they owe it to you as a result of the contract you signed, and they're going to honor that contract? I mean, I would think if these people, you know, have any moral compass whatsoever, if, you know, the world is really terrible, they're not going to go about bothering to bring you, you know, back. But, you know, it could be the case that there are terrible people out there, and maybe they figure, gee, we don't have enough slaves. Look, we've got all these cryopreserved guys around. Let's unfreeze them and use them as slaves.
Yeah.
But of course, if that happens, I think you can just commit suicide, right?
Well, I mean, assuming you're not virtualized and you have any power over your mind at all. If, for example, you were, you know, uploaded and now you are kind of some type of, and I know it's getting a little bit sci-fi, but some type of uploaded, you know, slave, and they can turn you on, turn you off, keep you going, however, you know, without any ability for you to change the circumstance. And I guess I'm wondering, even if the possibility of that is very slim and it's somewhat more of a fear than a eventuality, is the fact that it's possible at all a reason to not want your brain ever uploaded or copied? Because after all, you know, death is not an ideal situation. I would say it's neutral and life is, you know, positive, but you know, the concept of a virtual eternal, you know, torture in hell is so bad that even the smaller percentage chance may, you know, outweigh your wanting to ever be involved in, you know, this kind of uploading at all.
Right.
I mean, is that just fear mongering in my own brain, or is there?
I don't know. I don't know that you could totally dismiss that, you know, as impossible. I mean, so that would be one possible scenario if there's evil enough guys that have, you know, gained the reins of power, maybe they could do that. But the other thing is that I think that, you know, if they need slaves, why go to all the problem of unfreezing these cryopreserve guys? Just write the program and, you know, make the slaves that way. I don't
know. Oh, yeah. I mean, and maybe not even needing them, just, you know, there's these kind of evil people running around. Yeah, it starts I start feeling silly thinking about it, but it's
a very sadistic future you're postulating here, Daniel.
Yeah, I mean, but it's not the issue is there are sadistic people in this world right now, and there's not a tiny amount of them. There's a decent amount of horrible people, and what reason do we have to believe that there won't be those people in the future, and that, you know, those people won't have their new and upgraded technological means of being sadistic?
Right. Yeah, if that gives people satisfaction, I don't know. I mean, I guess that's a possibility. So do you know about Frank Tipler's omega point theory? So Tipler is one of the guys who invented the anthropic principle. So the anthropic principle is, you know, why do the physical constants have the values that they have? And the anthropic principle says, well, of course, if they didn't have the values that they have, we wouldn't be around to observe them. Yeah, that's a sort of interesting thing. But anyway, so Tipler says that, you know, along the same lines as Musk, as technology progresses, we're going to make games that are more and more indistinguishable from the real thing. And he says, you know, it's possible that at some point we're going to want to do ancestor simulations. We're going to want to see, gee, what would the world have been like if so this had happened or this wouldn't have happened and so forth. And so Tipler actually foresees a future in which every possible person gets resurrected inside a simulation. And so since, of course, we're part of the possible persons, because we're actual persons, we will be resurrected at that point too. So I guess we just have to hope that we're not in one of the terrible terrible simulations, right?
Well, Ted, it could be entirely possible that you are the real one being simulated and we're all just, you know, quasi-simulated. You know, we're only simulated as far as we need to be in order to convince you that we're fully simulated or fully
that's
real.
Exactly, yeah. That's exactly right.
Or, of course, any of our listeners out there, you know, they might be the real ones, or maybe them and their closest 1,000 friends and everybody else is just simulated only deep enough to make, you know, to keep the illusion going well enough.
Right.
It does seem like when one starts thinking about these kinds of scenarios, it just eviscerates our traditional notions of ethics and value judgments and all this, right? Because I was, Daniel and I were going on about this last night for hours, but, you know, we were thinking of scenarios like, well, what if, right, you know, right now, so, you know, we're starting this podcast on cryonics and all this, and what if, we wanted to find, what if uploading was sort of possible today, and we wanted to find out whether this, you know, whether podcasting was a great idea or whether we should become firemen or whether we should, you know, write the next best-selling novel. And so what we did was we made, you know, we uploaded three exact copies of ourselves onto a simulator and ran the simulation where we did one, the other, or the third thing for 10 years and then had our simulants write a report, you know, a 50-page report on at the end of that, how they felt and whether they thought it was a good idea, which they're going to submit to us at the end of that 10 years. And then we just shut them off afterwards, you know, okay, cool. You guys did your job. I'm going to read each of these and decide which of these, you know, three occupations I now want to pursue. But of course, if these are conscious entities, you know, with thoughts, emotions, and feelings and all the rest, it seems like I'm doing something wrong by just turning, you know, flipping the switch at the end of those 10 years. I've just committed murder three times over. But of course, then, you know, we can come up with all kinds of simulations like this about, you know, what if you simulate 10,000 people and for 30 seconds and then you shut off the simulation? Are you just a mass murderer on, you know, Hitler level scales or whatever? And how does that jive at all with what we consider ethical? You know, I don't know. This just breaks my intuitions in all kinds of ways.
Right. But no, I think that if these really are conscious, self-aware entities, then to just end their life like that would be a form of murder. I think that I just like with regard to a robot. I mean, if a robot is a conscious, self-aware entity, it should have the same sort of rights that we have, even though it's made out of silicon and steel. I think that granting general artificial intelligence rights is going to be the most difficult rights problem that we're going to face in the 21st century. I mean, so if we actually succeed in making conscious, self-aware robots, the question is going to arise, gee, do we have to give them the same sort of rights that we give each other? I mean, I guess this was the whole thing about the Matrix and all that sort of stuff, but I think it's a real possibility. And I think the mere fact that they're not made out of flesh and blood is irrelevant from a moral point of view. So the moral point of the question from a moral point of view is, you know, can you think, can you be self-aware, can you suffer? And if you can, then you deserve the same sort of consideration we give each other.
Does that become almost impractical? I mean, you know, what if you hear the story of, oh, you know, this 16-year-old, you know, turned on his computer, simulated 100 billion people for, you know, 5 minutes and then turned off the simulator and then did it again 30 times, you know, and, you know, how much justice must we, you know, how do we right the wrong that this person just committed? And if that's completely impractical and inconceivable to do that, doesn't, you know, does that make sense? Like, do we need to throw this person in jail for the next however long of their life? You know, do we just smack them on the hand and say, don't do that, that's bad? You know, but that seems so disproportionate, right, to what it right. would mean if they did that to flesh and blood people.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a great question. I mean, so, yeah, I mean, if it's that easy to make a simulated person by just, say, pushing a button, flipping a switch, you know, what do we say to the little kid who does that?
You know, it sounds like we could potentially, right, in the far future, be in that kind of world. Does that just mean we need an entirely new set of moral, ethical intuitions, or do we just, how do we control that? You know, how do we conceive of that? You know, the person who goes out and murders five people in actual flesh and blood versus the person who just murdered a billion people on their simulator, you know, when they were having lunch last Tuesday, you know, how do we deal with that in such a world, you know, and does that just mean we're going to throw out everything that we've learned from traditional consequentialism and deontology and virtue ethics. Forget it. It's all out the window. You know how? I don't know. I find it hard to conceive of these things.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. How do you deal with these simulated people if it's really easy to create them and really easy to destroy them?
Yeah, luckily, I don't think it's all going to happen kind of all at once in a vacuum. So I think
in the
lead up to these scenarios being possible, we'll, you know, have time to kind of vet these kinds of moral issues a little. We'll have at least some time. With exponential growth of technology, we won't have as much time as we like, but we'll have a chance at least.
But Ted, I wanted to... We're sort of in wrapping up here and having some closing thoughts. I wanted to get your thoughts on what about the sort of modern day ethical issues around cryonics? So, for example, would you say it's at all a selfish act to want to cryopreserve oneself or one's family, even though, you know, there's so many other uses for the resources that one could be putting into that? How should we conceive of this if we don't want to think of it as a selfish act?
Yeah, I don't think that it is a particularly selfish act. Although, you know, Timothy Leary was going to be cryopreserved, and there actually is an episode of the series that was narrated by Patrick McNee, the guy who played, you know, the guy with the bowler hat in Avengers and so forth. He had a myths and mysteries series of some sort, and he actually interviewed Timothy Leary before he died, and actually went to Alcor and interviewed the people that were going to do that. And I guess Timothy Leary ultimately decided that he didn't want to do it because, you know, he wanted to make sure that his grandchildren got the inheritance. He thought that this wouldn't be fair to the grandchildren to keep that money from them. But the thing is, you know, life insurance will pay for this. So my understanding anyway, so it doesn't have to take away from the inheritance. You just buy a life insurance policy that has, say, the $200,000 in it. I don't know what that amounts to, but it doesn't mean that $200,000 is coming out of your pocket necessarily. And so, you know, I think that there's ways to pay for it without depriving your loved ones or society and so forth. And, you know, it's a way to preserve life. I mean, we don't think twice about somebody who spends $200,000 to get a heart bypass surgery. I mean, if they can afford to get a heart bypass surgery, we don't say, well, just think of all the people in Africa they could have fed if they would have, you know, used that instead of getting the heart bypass surgery. So yeah, I don't think that it's necessarily selfish. I think an interesting possibility that was raised by the guys who pioneered this aldehyde stabilized cryopreservation, the sort of thing that you were talking about that actually turns the brain into a piece of plastic as opposed to, you know, freezing it in liquid nitrogen. So you're right. I mean, the brain to get frozen to plastic, the only way for it to come back, you can't reanimate the brain. You have to slice it up, right? But the brain features will be better preserved if the brain is aldehyde stabilized before the person dies. And so supposedly the people that worked for the company used to be called Nectome. I don't know if it's still called Nectome. Supposedly talked to certain lawyers in states that have physician-assisted suicide and asked, gee, might this be a way that we could commit suicide with the hope of, you know, eventually maybe being resurrected sometime in the future. And the lawyers that they talked to said they didn't see why not. So it would be an interesting way to commit physician-assisted suicide. So instead of taking some pills, you know, what you do is you have your brain aldehyde stabilized. And then you improve your chances of coming back.
Now, with people, usually euthanasia, you know, in the way we discuss it popularly, has to do with chronic diseases and, terminal illness.
Right. So the person would have to be terminal. But so I'm saying is that, so if you got somebody who qualifies for physician-assisted suicide, could you make this an option? So instead of taking pills, you have your brain aldehyde stabilized.
Yeah. Would you agree, or would there be any moral quandary at all with the idea of, you know, people being allowed to essentially have that same form of physician-assisted suicide, but not because they have a particular, terminal illness, unless you want to consider the possibility of dying a terminal illness, which essentially it is. But I know there are people who, you know, consider the thought that preserving themselves, you know, pre just getting very old, just so that they can, maintain, young, youthful brain matter, before, they start getting serious deterioration in their 80s and 90s. Is there any reason one could argue that that shouldn't be done, or is that just kind of a matter of personal liberty and the laws catching up with us?
Right. Well, I'm certain that the libertarians would say you should have the right to do with your body whatever you want to do. And if you want to have it frozen, even though you're not terminal, you should be allowed to do that. But of course, that would require a change in the law. But given the fact that certain states now do allow physician-assisted suicide, I think allowing cryopreservation as an option wouldn't require a change in the law necessarily.
There might be maybe a societal outcry if that becomes too popular of a method.
That's fine. That's possible. So there was a famous case. I think the guy's name was Thomas Donaldson, who knew that he had a deteriorating brain disease, and this was 20 or 30 years ago or something like that. And so he asked the California Supreme Court if he could be cryopreserved before the brain disease overtook him. And the California Supreme Court said no. But again, this was 20 or 30 years ago, before physician-assisted suicide was legal. So I wonder if somebody brought that to the California Supreme Court now, what they would say. Especially if these guys are, qualify under the Physician-Assisted Suicide Act.
Yeah, hopefully that would go better these days. Because, watching one's brain deteriorate in that way is it's no way to die. It's no way to die. It's no way to live. It's no way to be cryopreserved. It's
right.
One of the most horrible fates that I think could befall a person. Ted, it's been an awesome conversation. And as is so often the case with philosophical topics, they sometimes raise more questions than they answer. But at least it's a good tool set to be able to think about the subject more clearly and more concisely. So hopefully.
What I always say is that philosophy is confusing, but if I leave you confused at a higher level, then I figure I've done my job.
Perfect. Well, we'll wrap it up there. Theodore Schick, thank you very much for being part of the Cryonics Underground.
Well, great. Thank you for having me, Max and Daniel. And much success with your podcast.
Thanks. I should say, if there's anything you would like our listeners to check out or have a chance to read up on or anything else, let's throw that in there as well.
Right. Well, I do have a textbook called Doing Philosophy that has discusses these issues. There's a whole chapter on personal identity, goes through all the various sorts of theories and so forth. So it's called Doing Philosophy, An Introduction Through Thought Experiments. You might want to check that out. And then there's also How to Think About Weird Things, which talks about the different forms of possibility and how to evaluate whether something is rational or not.
Fantastic. Thank you, Ted. All right. Ted has left the virtual building. I wanted to leave you all with some closing thoughts and remarks on that interview. I think the question we were wrestling with at the start of the show on how to think about cryonics in the context of science, technology, and philosophy is very important. Lots of smart people that I respect, like Michael Shermer, people who also think carefully about things, really haven't been thinking very carefully about the subject of cryonics. And I think that could end up being a pretty big error, but hopefully we'll have discussions like these in the future, and we'll all learn to think more clearly about weird things.
time will tell. Perhaps that should be more of a saying in our community. As for questions of identity, I definitely kept pressing Ted on the matter as it relates to things like mind uploading and our experience of self. Hopefully you all found that subject as interesting as I do. In my informal surveys of chronicists, I've found that around half of everybody believes that whatever you're experiencing as a stream of consciousness, the you that you care most about isn't the same you that will open its eyes even after super high fidelity mind upload. It isn't the same you that will open its eyes in that new body. And about half of you do feel that entity, if it's a very high fidelity mind uploading technique, when it opens its eyes, will be you. And I'm being a little bit nebulous here with the word you, as one has to do in this situation. I wonder, did this episode change anyone's mind? I don't know. Well, maybe our brains are just genuinely wired very differently here, have very different intuitions about this. I'm reminded of an experience in a course I took on consciousness where the professor kept pushing us and telling us that he just couldn't believe that we actually had mental imagery, like we actually had the experience of seeing things in our minds. And it turns out at the end, what really was happening there was he really didn't have vivid mental imagery, and some of us did. So who knows? It could be that something like that is also going on with our conflicting intuitions here. At any rate, if you'd like to get in touch with us, Daniel and I can be reached at cryonicsunderground@gmail.com. That's cryonicsunderground@gmail.com. Or even better, come over and say hi to us at the Cryosphere, the Discord community that we're a part of. You can find it at the link we set up, bit.ly/cryonicsunderground. That's bit.ly/cryonicsunderground. Thanks, and we'll see y'all next week.